welcome to the Pirate Podcast. I'm not going to say what number episode it is because I don't really know. I'm here with Dan Davis, Head of Marketing at Pirate Studios.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. It's good to be back in Pirate Dalston.
Oh, yeah.
It's looking good.
I know, with the old office just around the corner.
Yeah. Good times.
Congratulations on being the first Aussie on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I've been in the UK for about 13 years now, and people can't hear the accent anymore, which it's just disappointing because I think I sound Aussie still.
But you do.
You think I do?
I do.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I love it.
I appreciate that.
I love an Aussie. I'm also now thinking, shit, did we have an Aussie on a previous episode? So sorry to any Australians that may have been on podcast already. I'll have to look through at some point and clarify later. Yeah, we're in Dalston. It's been a little while since we recorded the last podcast. That was also in Dalston back in November with Natty Lou. And today we're going to be recording with Plastician.
Plastic Man.
The Plastic Man, which is very exciting. He's just pulling into Dalston now. So, anything we need to cover off before we go and grab him?
Well, I think the interesting thing with Plastician is he used to work at Pirate back in the day in the Dalston office.
Mm-hmm.
And we had many good times with Plastician. So, yeah, lots to catch up on. Hopefully some reminiscing.
It should be a fun
good
one.
Times.
Once again, my mic has sagged down to a level where I really need to just this is so shit. Okay, we better go and get a Plastician.
Things
and
I'll
figure this out in the meantime. But yeah, cool.
Definitely not falling apart in the studio.
No, not at all. All right, bye. Okay, we are back here and we have found Plastician. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm good. It's good to be back here. Haven't been in the Dalston site for a little while, so always a pleasure, never a chore.
Love that. Dan's here too.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Dan.
Hi.
He did get an introduction earlier, just so you know. So we're all good. Yeah, we mentioned prior to you joining that we, you know, had a little office nearby.
Yeah.
Some fun times. And we'll probably come onto those a little bit later. Although I was talking to Adam, our COO, and he was like, just be careful that you don't talk about too much of the fun times. The funny thing is he doesn't know that some of the things I've said on this podcast previously about he and I in New York. So we'll see.
It's whole own podcast series, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's all fun and games though, obviously. So what we're going to do, as per usual, going to ask you a couple of questions to kick off just to, so I suppose you can introduce yourself to the audience. So first one being, tell us who you are and tell us how you got to this stage of your career.
So my real name's Chris. I perform as Plastician and I've been DJing, producing, running a label and just doing kind of general bits and bobs in the industry since probably going back about 2001, 2000, I think was when I sort of started out and then been full-time in the industry probably about 21 years now, I'd say. But started off just as a kind of hobbyist DJ interested in music and it just steamrolled from there really. It was never my intention to get into music as a career, but it just kind of turned into one.
Yeah. Wow. It's funny. We were looking earlier on Wikipedia. How long has Stish been doing what he does? I think we came up with 25 years, didn't we?
So yeah,
21.
Yeah,
21. Good.
I think 21's probably like full time. But yeah, it would be 25 years since I got like my decks. So starting out probably 25 years. But in terms of like taking jobs in the industry and then probably a few short of that.
Did you ever think it would lead to a podcast 25 years later?
Oh, I don't think they existed, did I?
Is this the peak? Is this
no,
the pinnacle?
Yeah, we've reached peak right now.
We really have, yeah. This is the best, yeah. That's interesting you mentioned that you didn't think it was going to turn into a career. I know I'm going completely off-piste now, so sorry. But I wonder, do you think over that kind of 21, 25 years to be confirmed, like more people kind of get into the industry thinking it's going to be a career, or has it at least got to a point where people can be like, you know what, this is what I want to do?
I think now probably more people thinking it will be, because I think there's a bit less sort of smoke and mirrors around like what the industry is and what artists do in their day to day, and also like at a lower level as well, how artists are a lot more honest about, you know, the normality of their life. So a normal person might think, well, I could do that. That could be a job for me or a part-time job that might, you know, turn into one. Whereas I didn't really know, you know, when I first started out, I just kind of wanted to DJ. And then that kind of rolled into the next thing. But my entry into it really was just, I just thought I wanted to have a go at mixing records, and so it was a bit of fun, ran your mate's house, whatever, having a mix. And then obviously the next thing is like, oh, it'd be great to get a gig, or it'd be great to get on the radio. And then it's, how do I get further up? It was just a massive ladder climb from all, and I think maybe now it's a little bit more easy to see where what all the steps of the ladder are. Yep. Whereas back then it was a bit like, what's next? And trying to figure out what next was, whereas I didn't really know what next was back then. Whereas now I think the steps are a bit clearer, a bit easier to see. Obviously we've got, you know, you can go through university and do like music business and stuff like that now, whereas I don't think that was a thing when I started out.
Yeah, or like become famous on TikTok overnight.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
Yeah, there was nothing like that. So it was like you needed to get signed, you needed management, you needed like promotion behind you, and you really, I think the thought of doing anything independently was like, you're not going to get far doing that.
Got it.
So it was like underground or pop star and not a lot in between.
Yeah, great. Dan, I know we discussed this previously about taking questions turn by turn. Do you want to ask the next one?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This is, it's a bit of a generic question, which is, how would you describe your musical style? But I'm actually quite interested to know how you'd answer that, because I think a lot of people might say, oh yeah, you know, Croydon dubstep, you know, but I think you've done a lot more than that. So yeah, how would you go about describing what your style is?
I think my style's always being kind of dictated by my taste in any given time. I think because my production style comes mostly from what I'm DJing. And obviously when I started out, I was only really playing UK garage.
Yeah.
And then that quickly turned into the early sort of stages of grime and dubstep. So by the time I actually started producing, I was just really trying to produce something that grime DJs would play, because that was kind of all I knew. It was like, it went from garage to that. And you know, as much as I knew other genres existed, I didn't know a great deal about them, and I didn't listen to them that much. So my influences were really quite narrow in that they were like just the offshoots of garage and what garage was turning into at the time that I started. And I think as I've got older and a bit more well-travelled, and, you know, I've experienced lots of different club nights and different genres, and I've met artists from different genres and listened to lots of different styles of music, that obviously comes into anything I'm producing now, is again similarly trying to sort of make something that I can fit into my DJ set that will work with all the other stuff that I'm really excited about or into at the time. A bit like a tool. I think a lot of music as a DJ, you think of it as like, where are you going to use that song in like your set? Like, where could I get away with playing that? And when I produce, I kind of attack it in a similar way that, oh, you know, I'm playing stuff that sounds like this and stuff that sounds like that. I need something that sits in the middle of those two, so I'm going to create this. And it might be like, you know, something that's kind of bassy and weighty like dubstep, but is a bit more rolling or has a bit more percussive, you know, is a bit faster, a bit more up tempo like breaks or grime. And that hasn't really changed. I think back in the early days for me, it would have been like trying to seat myself between grime and dubstep, because I was playing music from those two genres mostly, and I needed to make something that sat in the middle of them somewhere. And I think now it's similar, where I play lots of different genres. My production might sound a bit of a mix between like UK garage, but kind of darker or a bit more rolling. And, you know, I don't produce as much now as I used to, just because, you know, life gets in the way a lot more. But yeah, I still kind of approach any session I do with that mindset of trying to sound different but relevant to things that I'm into at the time.
Yeah.
I meant to say congratulations earlier for being our oldest podcast guest.
I'm not sure if I should be congratulated on that. Unless you're going to send me a letter and get it signed off by the king or queen.
I was wondering whether to dig you on that one.
You should get a letter from Bory or something.
No, it is interesting though, because you've had so much experience, and a lot of the answers to these questions on the podcast is like the relatively fresh and new, the people that we're talking to. So it's actually, it's great that you are old.
Yeah.
In this
hopefully,
case.
Some young people hearing this and they're like, oh, okay, I don't need to quit just yet.
Exactly. That's the hope. Cool. Well, that's the end of the get to know you questions, I guess. A quick question for you, Dan. Did you press record on the...
I did.
You
yeah,
did?
Yeah.
Nice. It's just going.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Fantastic.
Yeah. For the first time ever, we are filming video on the Pirate Podcast.
Not the first radio, mate.
Just straight on Stish's face. I'm calling him Stish, but you know, Plastician. We call him Stish. I call him Stish. Fucking hell. Does anyone else call you Stish?
Yeah, I get that good. A lot now. Yeah, I kind of, in different circles that I operate in, I'm probably known more as Stish than I am as Plastician. So,
there we go. Nice.
Yeah, kind of can rotate it around.
Love it. What about Man Plastic?
Man Plastic. I nearly actually called myself that. I don't know if you've...
What?
I don't know if that was pure chance.
No, that is pure chance.
Yeah, so I can't remember what year it was now, but I had to change my name because I used to produce as Plastic Man and there was another artist who was already using that name. Ah. And kind of, it come to a head where it's like, look, you can't use that name anymore. You're kind of stepping on my toes a bit. And kind of had to hold my hands up and be like, okay, probably I'm going to have to change it. So changed it to Plastician. But there was a kind of like a few weeks of like, what can I call myself without changing it too much? And Man Plastic was one of them. I thought, I don't like that. Doesn't roll off the tongue. Just sounded
weird. That
would have
been a different career, I think.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that before. It sounds horrendous now you say that. But yeah, that was one of the options that was kind of thrown in there. It wasn't given much consideration, that one. But it was, I can't remember who, someone came up with that. And I was like, yeah, nah.
Like, got it. Wow.
Yeah, Plastician was because I only had to change one letter in the name, but then the name changing its sound was like good enough for like legal.
Got it.
If it's spoken differently, it's
I see.
Seen as different.
Interesting. Mm. Okay. Yeah, that wasn't researched.
Oh, there you go.
But there you go.
A little bit of trivia there for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we have like a bunch of questions here. I think we've got nine written down in front of me. We'll probably get to ask five or six. You've read these, right?
Yep, yep.
Don't worry if you haven't. Was there any in particular? I'm not gonna ask you that. I tell you what, if I ask you one, you're like, don't want to answer that one, it's shit. Then
I'll
let me
you
know. And then I reckon that Dan, if Dan and I alternate,
yep.
Dan's going to ask like really good ones, and I'm just going to do like probably pretty boring ones because Dan's creative and I'm not. So I'm just going to jump straight in with, you know, how do you approach song production and finding inspiration for your music?
I think at the moment, at my current sort of stage in my life, because I've got kids and I've got so much stuff going on, that I think energy is a big thing. I really have to be in the mood now, and that just sometimes just presents itself to me. I can't work myself up into that mood. I can't I can't sort of dig for inspiration. It just kind of happens sometimes. And I think like today or this week, I've actually started working on some music for the first time in what feels like months. It might even be longer than months.
So we inspired you, is what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe it was a part
of
that. I can't even put my finger on like what the moment was, and I don't know what it was at all, to be honest. It might be something stupid, like, you know, you just get like something stuck in your head, like a little riff going off in your head, like, Dan, you write, that might be what it's like for you, but I can't remember what it was. Something maybe just triggered this thought to go in and just start writing and see what happened. So that sometimes is just, you know, it'll come like a spark, you know, people call it like the muse. Maybe it is something like that. I don't know. But in terms of approaching it, because my inspiration is so like sporadic and unusual in that case, I never really go in with any plan. It's just like, right, let's just start messing around with sounds and see what sounds good. And maybe I'll drag a few sounds, a couple of loops or riffs maybe these days. So I work more with like loop. Obviously, loops weren't really a thing. Starting out, but it would have been maybe samples and stuff like that. But now you can get like these loops, which are as good as samples. And then I'll sometimes load something like that in and build around it and then build away from it. So I'll take it out and rebuild sections so that I have like original loops and not something that someone else might have found in a splice pack or something like that. So I'd say like in terms of like now compared to like back in the day when I started out when I was young, it was kind of like, it sounds really horrible to say it and admit it, but it was more enjoyable. It was like a bit of fun. Have some fun. I treated like opening Fruity Loops up similarly to like turning an Xbox on to like, you know, have some fun, mess about.
Yeah.
Whereas I think now because I've been in the industry and this is my job, you know, like, well, you got to do some music. You haven't released anything for a while. You have, so there's that in the back of your head sometimes, which is like not very inspiring, but there is a need to kind of go in and start, at least try and create. You know, I'm quite accepting of the fact that when I do get to the studio, it might not be very good. Some people are like, you know, got to finish it. Has to, like, when are we putting it out? And it's like, I haven't even finished track yet. This might not ever come out. You know, there's way more tracks on my hard drive that are unfinished and will never hear than there are finished. That's for sure. And so I think that my approach to it is a little bit like, you get a mix of like, oh, you better do this, and a mix of, you don't have to do it. Like, so I do have a bit of trouble with that. Whereas some people are like, they've got that hunger and that love and that fun. Sometimes it feels like work to me, but sometimes it doesn't. So I think once you get into it, once you get into that flow of it, it can be quite fun. And I think before it was always fun. Now it's a bit like, I'm thinking about other things I've got to do. Oh, I've got that email I need to do, that meeting to do. Oh, I need to pay that person. I've got those bills. Oh, my car's in the garage tomorrow. The kids need to be picked up. There's so much going on that was never in my mind before.
Yeah.
It was just much more focused on what I was doing. And I think that's probably not dissimilar to a lot of people outside who are even just starting out. I think that we have a lot more distractions now than obviously when I was in my sort of late teens, early 20s. It was like the internet on a computer, not on your phone. You know, telephone, you might have the odd text message coming through, but people didn't sit on their phones all day texting back and forward. I've never liked doing that anyway. But once you were in the studio, you weren't really looking at anything else. You were literally just looking at the screen and getting stuff done. And I think that I was getting a lot more finished back then. So sometimes I've gone through periods in my production process of actually like turning the internet off as well. I don't use, like I said, I've mentioned Splice. I don't use Splice or anything like that really. I use like loop packs if I'm using loops. So I don't really need the internet turned on while I'm on like my DAW or DAW, whatever you call them. But yeah, I'd say my process is I hit and hope. It's a bit like hopefully something sounds good. And then if it does, then I find getting it finished a lot easier. Whereas if I've got to finish that, I can take months. It's like, oh, that track again. Don't want to go and finish it. So yeah, it is a bit of a mystery what's going to happen. I don't really have like a solid process in that sense.
Yeah. No, thank you for that.
Do you ever feel, you know, because you've been at this for you know, 20 odd years now, if you've not got that sort of inspiration at any given moment, but you know there's maybe some kind of pressure to release something or you need to get something out there, you know, do you ever feel pressure? Are you ever tempted to sort of, I guess, you know, give the people what they want in a sense and like do a particular sound that you know people are going to love or, you know, do you ever sort
I always feel it, but I very often succumb to it. I think that like one of the things I always see about myself will be like, oh, his old music. And it's like, I can make stuff that sounds like that, but be only relevant to people who are like hungry for that nostalgic hit that they'll get from hearing me do something. But also from experience, if you do that, it's still not the same because what they want is not that sound. They want that feeling they got when they heard that sound when they were 18. You can never have that again. So even if I made a track that sounded like, let's say, Japan, people are like, oh, like I've done that. I've made songs that kind of in my head go in, get some kind of oriental sound samples, use some kind of like woody drum sounds, like put like a Reese bass in, done it. It never had that connection with people the same way that Japan might have done with the people that would moan about that, because they're not chasing the sound, they're chasing the nostalgic feeling. And those attachments are to the experiences they had to the music, not the music itself. So I would say that as much as I always kind of see that pressure, from experience, I've kind of been there, done that, tried it. It's never going to be the same as the song that you produced, even if in your head it's like, this is similar, but I think it's better. It's like, it'll be better for the next generation of people that are experiencing that song in like their, and having their moment to that song. And then 10 years down the line, it'll be that song that they're nostalgic for. You know, it'll just be a different group of people. So the pressure's there, definitely, but I would say that... You can never really, you can never really like bottle that up and sell it. It's really hard to do.
Your turn, buddy.
I guess probably following on from that question, you know, given the career that you've managed to sustain now, and I think pretty early on, am I right in saying you launched your own label,
yeah,
Terror Rhythm? Did you find, you know, was launching your own label, is that a really important part of how you've managed to maintain the career that you have, do you think? Or and what made you decide so early on that was something you wanted to do?
So the reason it started as early as it did was because my experience at that point in the industry, apart from being a DJ and producing myself, was I worked in distribution. So I used to be a telesales rep for a distribution company. I used to have to literally play records down the phone to every record shop in the UK, deliver them by hand in some case to the ones in London, at the back of a van. So I knew how that side of the industry worked. All you had to figure out then was, how do I press records? And that was pretty easy to do back then, and it wasn't that expensive either compared to like now. You could get 500 white labels pressed up. You'd have the test pressings in a week, and then you had the full press in like 14, 15 days for like £500. And then you'd sell those to the shops at £2.50 to £3.50 per unit. They'd sell them for like £7 to £8, depending on like how much they thought they could sell them for. So you can make a half decent profit quite easily. And knowing all the shops as I did, it made like total sense to just do it. So that was, for me, it was like, well, why wouldn't I start a label? I know way more than most of the people that were putting particularly like grime out at that time. I was like ahead of a lot of them in that sense that I can now produce. I've had a couple of releases out on other people's labels where, you know, you're only going to get 50% of the profit back from that. That's the kind of standard deal you'll get. If I run my own label, do it myself, I'm taking 100% of the profit. So it was just like a no-brainer for me in that sense. And I think over time, obviously, I've run the label, I've put other people's music out, which means that, you know, I now act as the label. If I find an artist that I think's particularly good, you know, it's not always a monetary thing, but if that artist resonates with the audience that you're selling to, then you will reap the benefits of promoting that, putting them on a platform alongside the more established acts that you've released down the years. And yeah, you know, it hasn't earned loads of money, but I think the label's catalogue maybe has like 400 songs on it, something like that now. You know, some of them earn £50 a month, some of them earn nothing now, because Spotify, if you don't get 1,000 streams a year, it earns nothing. And really and truthfully, like, Spotify's pretty much the be all and end all when it comes to streaming revenue anyway. It's cornered such a big chunk of the market that we rely so heavily on it. But then, you know, we do quite well out of Bandcamp as well. And I think labels like mine that are, you know, quite small independents with a bit of kind of communication to your audience and your buyers, they are quite happy to go to Bandcamp and buy, knowing that they're supporting the artist 100-fold based compared to like streaming it every day on Spotify for a year or whatever. So yeah, we do, it's definitely helped. Yeah, it's probably not so much now, because I think the streaming royalties are just down so much year on year, and will be even more so next year onwards. But yeah, I think if I kind of look at like what my monthly kind of income is, on a quiet month, it's probably about 40% of my income, like the label, really. The gigs is where you normally earn the most money, but they're becoming more scarce now because of the, you know, we're losing all the clubs. Yeah, there's loads of factors in that, obviously, but that's probably an entire podcast on its own.
Yeah, unfortunately. Do you ever play Paragon in New York? Do you know it?
I know the venue. I've not played there.
They're closing down now as well.
So really?
That, yeah, it's just like...
Yeah, I mean, they're dropping like flies at the moment.
I know, it's really sad. The reason I'm asking this one is I really want to know the answer to the question. And also, I think people will enjoy it. But what is the best gig you've ever played? And could you like take us through it? Just in the, you know, in the theme of playing out.
I think there's so many like memorable ones. I was trying to kind of think this one through in my head. One that really always has, there's two that particularly stick out in the memory. One was, I want to say it was 2006, it was Forwards at Plastic People. It was like JME's birthday bash. And it was just a particularly busy, Forward was very busy anyway, but this one was like, you couldn't move in there. And it was being broadcast on Rinse at the time, like live as well. And there was just a different energy in there. I think maybe like the grime crowd in a small venue like that versus like your general kind of Forward crowd, which was a bit more relaxed. Whereas grime was a bit more like aggressive. And I think I started playing and I had Skepta and God's Gift on the mic. And they were going back to back. And there was just this wild energy at the front of the stage to the point that the booth there was very low and it's very close to people. They had this enormous like mixer, like this horrendous thing that we had to use, big red, can't remember the name of the brand now, it will come to me in a minute, but Formula Sound mixer. And it was just mounted in this enormous like MDF, like almost like a coffin that sat on up and out of the booth. And somehow it got so rowdy at the front that someone like pushed that, and the mixer and the whole like thing that it was seated in kind of like pushed off the booth, and I was like almost like caught it before it fell off of the table. Whoa. And had to like push it back on. And I was like, what is going on here? This is like insane. And Sarah Lockhart, who ran the night, kind of came to the booth and was like, you guys need to stop emceeing, like people are, it's getting a bit crazy. And it really was, but that was just one of the most crazy, like the energy for like a couple, 5-10 minutes was just like, people, it was like, the people are going to kill each other in a minute. It was like, it was so intense.
Wow.
So it's quite memorable. And then similarly there, I think it was Outlook 2010, I think, which was like, in terms of that sort of like dubstep peak, I think that was like peak, like where dubstep and bass music was like borderline mainstream. You've got Outlook Festival out in Croatia, and I think I played the first like big night. I think it's a Friday night, I think. It was either Thursday or Friday, but it was like people there were fresh, you know. All the stages were being opened up for the first time that night. So people were going to get their first taste of like the full Outlook Festival. And I was playing in the Mungo's stage, which is kind of like, it's almost like an alley. This really holds the sound in well, and Mungo's sound system's really good.
Yeah.
And I played one of the earlier sets, but it was like, you know, it was one of the first like nighttime sets where like the fort was packed. Most people were in the fort at that point. And I was playing quite heavy back then. I just remember looking out and there was like this art installation like going along the kind of side of the fort that was made out of polystyrene. And it had like light, it was kind of like a light show onto the polystyrene, like 3D mapping and that. And I looked out about 5 minutes into my set, which felt like everything I was doing was just working. Everyone's going mental, like, but in a good way, you know, the vibes were just massive. And I looked out and there was like this guy on someone's shoulders and they were just like, he was like headbutting this polystyrene stuff off, and it was like it was just like carnage. But I'm not selling it. I'm making it sound like a good gig to me. It's just like people like not behaving very well. But it was,
that's the whole point.
It really was like the energy in that space at that time was just, I remember coming off the decks and was like, oh my God, that was amazing. I want to do that again. But yeah, there's been some interesting gigs down the years, played in like I played in a train station in France. That was quite interesting. Did a massive show in Chicago. It's like 4,000 people, the Masquerade there. You know, I've played the Best Buy Theatre in New York. I've done some enormous venues, you know, the O2. I've done gigs all over the place, really unusual gigs. But for me, like those ones where like you are literally like, you feel like you're in amongst it with everyone. I like being really close to the crowd. Sometimes when I'm a bit further back, you know, like big festival stages and that I've played, which look fantastic on your CV, but actually the experience of them a bit different sometimes. You feel a bit removed from the energy. I like to feel like I'm a part of it.
Yeah.
And, those gigs where you're kind of right in there.
Nice.
That's the one for me.
perhaps unsurprisingly, my favourite was probably, what, it would have been circa 2017, Boomtown Pirate Stage.
That was good. Mm. With Scream.
Yeah. I just remember like the whole thing just like rocking.
I mean, that's definitely up there as well. That was insane.
Oh, you'd have to say that.
No, it definitely was.
Oh, okay.
Fine. Even Scream says it, that we definitely talk about that a lot. That was a proper moment.
We still get comments, genuinely, to this day, just random messages being like, have you got, like, you guys that's definitely filmed that set.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We do have it. We've got the footage locked away
in a vault.
In
somewhere.
A vault.
I feel like it was one of them ones where it's like, if we started to share it, it would almost like lose the notoriety that it has.
Yeah,
it was that. You had to be there. It was a bit like, you know, like then people have those stories of like seeing Prince play in like a jazz cafe or something like that. And it's like, that's going to be like, oh, Prince in a jazz cafe.
Yeah. And you wouldn't want to watch the video of Prince and realize that he was like well off key.
Yeah. That's it. That's what I reckon as well. I bet we would watch it back and be like, oh, that's a dodgy mix or something like that. It'd be like, yeah, you start opening it up for people. And everyone that was in there will only tell you about how good it was because, again, like the energy in that space, in that small space where everyone was packed in, and it was like you had to find out about it to get in. And you know, even the backstage area was just like loads of DJs that were kind of like nerding out on the old like screenplay and dubstep again for the first time in years. And yeah, it was, that was a special one, definitely.
Yeah, that was so good. Dan, I'll go over to you, just a warning that we're probably about 10 minutes.
Yeah maybe we'll go this one and then end on the pirate one.
Yeah, well, cool. Did you think about something for the final question?
I had to be very careful.
Okay, fine. Go on then.
I'm quite keen to find out. I mean, I know you get sent a lot of music on SoundCloud and the like. Is there anyone at the moment, you know, be it MCs or producers or anyone doing anything that you think's interesting that you got your eye on that, you know?
It's quite a tough one because I think I think I might have mentioned this to you like off air as well, where like it's really hard to be super excited about anything at the moment. And that's not me being a complete pessimist, but I just think that we're inundated with stuff. Everyone's doing stuff. Everything's so quick. It's like fast hits, almost like fast food. It's like asking me like, what's the best McDonald's you've ever had? It's like, we have it all the time. So it's like music at the moment. It's so hard for someone to be so individual, but still good enough that they somehow break through the noise of the algorithm. And I think because of the way these algorithms work, we're constantly being fed things that sound or look like stuff that we previously enjoyed.
Yeah,
it's hard to get excited about something that we already feel familiar with, you know?
And you see that, don't you, on like playlists?
Yeah, definitely.
Stuffed with stuff that just sounds like, you know,
absolutely,
stuff that happened in the 90s. And these things get millions of streams because I'm guessing it just goes on a playlist. Someone plays it in the background.
Exactly. And yeah, we get a lot of that. And I think it's just, you know, like individuality is at the kind of, what's the word? It's up to the algorithm to kind of treat individuality with a new respect. It doesn't, you're never going to get fed something that sounds different, you know? And that means that like crate digging and going through those kind of SoundCloud digs is really important now. And again, it comes down to times hard to find the time that, you know, when I did weekly radio, I reckon I spent close to a day of my week just listening to stuff on SoundCloud and find something you like, go into the artist they follow. What's this? Who's that? Finding the little works in progress, emailing them or messaging them on SoundCloud. Can I get this for radio, blah, blah. And I think we're not many people or artists in general now, and maybe not as like active on SoundCloud as they used to be back in the like mid-teens or whatever we're going to call that era. But everyone's on Instagram, and, you know, to do well on Instagram, you have to think about the way you're posting your music differently to like just posting it on SoundCloud and hoping it picks up some traction. It needs to be about more than the music you're making. So there can be like these genius tracks or really clever bits of music, but if there's not a funny meme attached to it, or it doesn't have like a hooky, like funny lyric that happens right before the next part happens that you can put in context to like a video of like someone kind of like coming home to the kids or something. That's the world we live in. So you're more likely to discover music attached to a meme or something. And that's even the case for people like me, you know, like I'm scrolling Instagram all the time, way more than I wish. I've actually deleted it off my phone a few times down the last couple of years because it's almost an addiction. And I think that is sapping time away from actively looking for music, like more than I wish it would. But that's the honest truth of it. And I think that because of that, I'm finding, or I'm seeing less really exciting music because it's just like the same stuff. You're saying more of stuff that sounds like this or that. And it's like, I don't want stuff that sounds like, I need stuff that excites me. And it's been a while since anything like that. And I was thinking about this the other day and I thought, some of the artists that come through in recent years, or at least like onto my, I remember hearing like Nicki Nair for the first time. I don't know what year it was. It was a few years back now, probably pre-COVID. But I remember thinking, this is pretty fresh. Like, it's kind of got like an electro influence to it, but it's quite a lot more going on, but also catchy. Whereas a lot of those kind of like IDM leaning producers will just make something that sounds really weird. He will take like some of the weird, but make it catchy a little bit. Like if you go further back, I think that's a big part of the reason that someone like Skrillex really like took off, because he took that kind of like really heavy dubstep sound that was just beats and bass and was like, I'm going to put this insane riff over the top of it. That was like just as wild and noisy, but kind of catchy. Mm. And a lot of dubstep at that time wasn't making it that hard, but also that musical at the same time. So that's what really like shot him. And it's like, someone's going to get somewhere with something sooner or later. I think we're all kind of in this holding pattern at the moment of like, what's next? Mm. Everything's kind of in this flat. We're in a bit of a flat period where everything sounds a bit like UK garage, or a bit like Breaks, or, you know, like the kind of, the everything's a mix of everything, which is cool, because I think that's when you do start to get the clever bits start to come. But I think at the moment, everything's a bit multi-genre. We need a little bit of, some of the artists are just like focusing on like something and go make that their own. And then it'll be like, oh, that's cool. And then of course you get all the copycats of that, and that becomes the next thing. But
so if there's a producer out there listening to this who's sat on the thing,
yeah,
the new sound,
I think that's it. Find your niche and try and own it. Yeah, like just really double down on that. And yeah, if you can stand out but be good at the same time, right now I think you'll do really well. But then of course, get some memes.
Memes.
I'll be a bit more comfortable on camera or something, I don't know. But yeah, some of the people that kind of break through are, funnily enough, those people who are actually really good on Instagram as well.
Yep. Okay, listeners probably have caught on to the fact that we all work together mm-hmm. at one point in time. So yeah, to finish up, going to ask you to tell us a little story from back in the day. Hopefully you thought of one. You could also just go off the cuff, that's fine. But yeah, just I thought it'd be a nice way to end
it. I did think about this a bit and I thought, is there like a story that really sticks out? I mean, there's so many like funny nights out and the socials, and you know, I'll always remember, because I bumped into him recently, but you remember Robbie Duncan, who used to work?
Yeah, love Robbie.
So he came to my gig I played in Cheltenham the other week, and I'm DJing, and he just like tapped me, and he's like, Chris, because he lives in Stroud or something, around the corner from there. So I had a really brief chat with him, and he was like, do you remember when you saved my life? And I was always, my wife and I laugh about this quite a lot, because I'm Robbie's twice my size as well. And we went white water rafting. I think it was like part of a celebration. The bigger reveal, the pirate like managing to nail a big round of funding was like huge for the company. So we were treated to a big day out at the white water rafting at the like Olympic Village in, where was it? Like in Essex somewhere, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then we went, was it? I want to call it, it's not shuffleboard, is it? What was that thing?
I think it's shuffleboard.
No, it's like giant shuffleboard. I should know the actual name for it.
It's almost like curling, isn't it?
My friend competes like professionally in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Anyway.
Any which way, yeah, we were out doing that. But I've never felt the fear more in my life than when I fell out of that white water, even though it's in like very closed, safe conditions. You're not like out in the wilderness, right? But I can still remember how I felt when I hit that cold water coming out of that thing.
Wow.
And kind of bobbing up, and there's like the lifeguard sort of running along, which they do whenever anyone, which, you know, I think most of us fell in the water at some point that day. And I remember got kind of dragged out to the side, and then I see Robbie kind of like bobbing around, and he's like, he's got the fear in his eyes. The man looked like he was gonna, like he was at one with God at that moment in time. And we'd been taught how to kind of like, you kind of like dip, you lean over into the water and you kind of like push them under with their by their kind of a life vest, don't you?
Mm.
And then that's supposed to kind of like help them kind of pop back up. So then you pull them up onto the riverbank. So I'm there and I'm thinking, there's no way I'm getting Robbie out. He's like he's twice my size. Somehow I managed to pull him out, I don't know, by the grace of God or something. And he never let me forget that. And even the other day when he came to my gig, he was like, you saved my life. You saved my life. So it always sticks in my memory as like a kind of PC one, because I think like some of the party stories was definitely not for the podcast, but we had some amazing. I always love the Mark Rabille live stream at the Lion and Lamb, the first one we did.
That
was insane. One of like the craziest. I think that was like one of my best days working for Pirate. You were there, Dan, and it was just like everything happened. We planned it meticulously. He did the best performance. The live stream went off, and I remember feeling really good when we finished that. It was like absolutely knackered. It was such a long day. But I think it was like, wow. I think, and watching back that stream as well, like how good all the shots and the angles were, really captured the energy in the room. And yeah, that for me was like, that was a big day working for Pirate.
Also, you know, considering he's playing festivals and stuff now, it's like to enormous. See him in a little room like that, get it captured.
His first ever gig in the UK as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I saw him at Coachella year before last.
Oh, he's incredible. He's massive.
Incredible. Yeah.
He gets name checked in like Hollywood movies now and stuff. It's
wow.
Nuts. Damn. But yeah, at the same time, it's like we both had the same agent, and I was like, he's doing a gig in London. I'm working for this company. Can we stream it? And then we had him. We streamed his gig at the Jazz Cafe again as well, didn't we?
Yeah, you interviewed him as well.
Yeah. That's still on YouTube, I think. Yeah, it's that was wicked. And obviously, like, my involvement in Boomtown that year that you spoke about, that was really good, getting to curate that whole weekend, get to work with loads of artists that obviously we kind of, like, brought into the kind of Pirate family, if you like, through helping them out with studio sessions. And, yeah, I think it's a very rewarding job if you work in music to work at a company that tries to support, you know, like grassroots from, you know, cheap studio, but also the opportunity to play at these festivals. And yeah, it was a very rewarding role getting to do that. So there's so many good memories, but yeah, I think, you know, the socials as well were just, I think everyone at the company is just a good laugh, and I think that's part of getting a job at Pirate. I don't think that'd be hiring any donuts or
one or two
donuts. Nah. Who know how to have a beer,
mate. Yeah, is that right?
Of course. So yeah, no, thank you so much for that. I joked about it a little bit earlier about, you know, being oldest on a podcast, whatever. Yeah. But like, this has been the best one we've done, just because there'll be people who listen to this, and just because of your like wealth of knowledge from the last, you know, 20-25 years, people can learn so much from, you know, your career and what you've kind of talked about today. So thank you so much for coming in.
Cheers, having me.
Yeah, of course.
It's always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dan. I'll see you on the next one, Dan. All right, cheers, Dan.